Okay, thank you very much. So today I'm going to speak. Today I'm going to speak about exit times statistics in turbulent signal, or as many people prefer to call them, inverse statistics in turbulent signal. And I'm going. This is a work done in collaboration with Guido Boffetta and Antonio Celani from the University of Torino. Indeed, Antonio now is in Nice, at the Observatory of Nice, and with Massimo Cencini, Davide Verdi, and Angelo Vulpiani from University of Rome, La Sapienza. So what do I mean with exit time? Well, it's a very simple idea indeed, and the idea is the following. Instead of look at the usual way to measure velocity fluctuations in turbulent signals is to measure velocity structure functions. What you do in that case, you just fix some time increments. Let me suppose I have a one-dimensional turbulent velocity signal, v as a function of time, could be as a function of r, I mean, it's, there are no differences, just to fix the notation. And then when you measure velocity structure function, you just fix some time increment, and then you go and you measure what's the typical velocity fluctuations that you have on that fixed time increment, and then a change in time increment, you measure what moments of velocity differences are called structure functions, and everybody knows that they are anomalous in the sense that they show power law behavior as a function of delta t with exponents which are nonlinear in p and therefore are called anomalous exponents. The inverse statistics is just the opposite. Instead to look at fixed at velocity fluctuations as a function of fixed delta t, you look at time increment fluctuations as a function of fixed velocity fluctuations. That is what a typical exit time experiment. You want to fix some delta v barrier, and then you go all along your time series, and you measure what's the typical fluctuations in time that you need to see that the velocity field has a fluctuation of the order of delta v with fixed delta v. And then you are going to change delta v, and you want to study the moments, the probability distribution function of these exit times. Well, let us. Because it's the time the signal needs to exit from a fixed barrier, okay? And eventually you want to measure or you want to control what is the probability distribution function of this exit time observable, and you want to say something about for instance moments. So the first question is: do we expect to have some new information on the turbulent signal by looking at these observables with respect to the usual one or not? In principle,
modulo or delta v inside?
Delta v modulo, yeah, well, modulo if you want.
That
is the same, yes. Going down or going up is the same, yes. Yeah, if you want, yes. In principle, yes. So, do we expect to have new information on the turbulent signal or not? In principle, let me say, our feeling was that if the signal is indeed multi-affine, I mean, it's anomalous, then you do not have any reason to expect that these animals are going to give the same information that you have been measuring directly. Yes. Yeah. Well, you assume it's a stationary. I mean, velocity field is a stationary process. I mean, turbulent velocity field is a stationary process. Well, as for velocity increments, it shouldn't be that different. I mean, fluctuations. If you have a zero mean velocity field, that you can always do it because I mean you translate it by the mean, then positive velocity fluctuations or negative velocity fluctuations should be equivalent, I mean, equiprobable. Or, I mean, if they are not, I agree with you that you may have different information by looking at the statistic with sign or statistic without sign, like in the structure function where you have some observables that do not depend on the sign, some other depend on the sign. We did it by looking at modulus of the velocity differences. And so the first observation is that if the signal is really anomalous, that is, these zeta p exponents are not linear in p, then in principle, as I will argue in later, the delta the axis time statistics is going to give us definitely different information on the probability distribution function of the velocity field. So what has been done with this axis time approach? Well, mainly there have been works on two different directions. There have been Eulerian measurements, that is, we have done and we have studied the exit time statistics, which means if you translate it on the what you really are measuring about the velocity field properties, it means that you are measuring the peaks of the probability distribution function of velocity differences, because it's clear that when you're measuring an exit time, what are the typical velocity configuration that are going to give you the dominant contribution in the exit time? Well, it's when the velocity field is laminar. Because if the velocity field is laminar, I mean, it's almost constant, let's say, then it's going to have a very long, you have to wait for a very long time before that that velocity fluctuations experience trespass some given barrier. More clear that if you have a laminar phase like that, and you want to look at the exit time along some given barrier, then you see that given barrier like that. Then you see that if you have a laminar phase, the exit time event is going to be given by a very long exit time, and therefore positive moments of the exit times are going to be dominated by this event. So exit time is a natural way to look at the peaks of the probability distribution function of velocity differences that are, let's say, laminar phases in your turbulent signal. People in the past tried to look at these events, I mean, at the peaks of the probability distribution function by looking at the inverse, at the negative moments of the structural function. But that, in most of the cases, do not exist because you have a non-zero probability, you have a zero velocity fluctuation. So while in this case, you have a perfectly well-defined observable, which is going to measure what happens to the peaks of your probability distribution as a function of the velocity fluctuation.
That doesn't mean that it will be asymmetric about the mean, does it?
What do you mean
symmetric? The probability distribution that you drew.
Well, it may be symmetric, may also be not symmetric. I mean, yes. That if you measure with the modulus, I mean, for the non-zero structural function, it's not symmetric, for instance. If you measure with the modulus, anyhow, you're going to measure only the symmetric part of the probability distribution function. So the symmetrized part of what happens close to the peak. And looking at the moments of the exit time statistics, brought us to the understanding of what is going on about the intermediate dissipative range for these exit times. I'm going to spend some time about this point. That is, as I will show in a few moments, the exit time moments are completely dominated by viscous fluctuations, and this is somehow connected by the fact that you're looking at the laminar fluctuations in your turbulent flow. I will be more precise about this point in a few minutes. Then there is one week ago during the last conference, Greg proposed to use the exit times to measure non-trivial velocity fluctuations in the direct cascade regime, where we know that the direct structure functions are absolutely trivial up to a logarithmic factor, while it is not clear to me, maybe to Grisha, you have some insight. Maybe in the inverse statistics, I mean, the x-time statistics may reveal something of non-trivial also in the direct cascade regime of this movement. So this is something like a proposal for the future. And then we also recently worked on the epsilon entropy measurements. This epsilon entropy is a well-known observables of any dynamical system, deterministic of stochastics. You may prove that by using the exit time statistics, you have an optimal way to measure the epsilon entropy. And therefore, you can also apply this trick to measure the epsilon entropy, for instance, of turbulent flows. Yes?
That would be very interesting. I mean, this still follows the terms of the normal, but the PDF of exit time is a very important aspect.
Yeah.
It could be translated into spiral.
Yeah, I agree with you. It may be interesting. Yeah. Just think about this. Yeah. And Then there have also been attempts, I mean, indeed, historically speaking, the first time the XC time has been used in turbulent communities is by looking at Lagrangian measurements, and people have proved that by using the XC times, you may definitely improve your ability to measure the Dirichlet diffusions, and eventually also correction, intermittent corrections to the Dirichlet diffusions. And they've also been applied to diffusion close to backing, but I won't have time to speak about that point. So let me start very briefly about just to understand what happens in the Lagrangian case, why exit times are crucial if you want to really measure the Richardson diffusion. What do you expect about the Richardson diffusion? Well, you know that if the what you're going to measure, you're going to measure the statistics of pair dispersion between the statistics of the distance between two particles that are affected by your turbulent flow. So this is not a one-point statistic, I mean the distance between two particles. And you know that if the distance between two particles, I mean that is the well-known Richardson proposal, that the square of the interparticle distances should go like T over Q, but if R is inside the inertial range of scale from your turbulent flow. Indeed, as you maybe know, this is one of the worst measured quantities in turbulence, because there are many experimental and numerical problems in having a very clean T over cube, T to the cube regime. And we think that we understand why, and indeed it's possible to have a very clean measurement of this guy by looking at the exit time statistics. The problem that you have in measuring this guy by just looking at the usual way of measuring it is that, indeed, you know, you won't have only the Richardson regime, but you will also have, in principle, you have three different regimes. If the interparticle distance is less than the viscous dissipation scale of your turbulent flow, then you expect the flow is laminar, and therefore you expect an expression divergence of trajectory due to just to deterministic chaos. And what is interesting is that this gamma, the exponent which tells you how fast is the exponential divergence, is going to fluctuate as a function of time, as a function of space, because in average it's the Lyapunov exponent of your flow, but it's going to have strong fluctuations in time and in space. Then if R is larger than the dissipative scale and smaller than the integral scale, you know that you should have the Richardson diffusion. And then eventually if R is larger than the integral scale, then velocity field is decorrelated, you should have the usual diffusion. So why, indeed, what I'm just now claiming is that if you measure the R squared dispersion as a function of time, these three regimes are going to overlap one with the other and do not allow you to measure anything in a realistic way. The reason is the following. Let's try to depict it here. Some horrible way of thinking. Here there are the three. Let me suppose we perform three experiments. We three pairs of particles well inside the dissipative range, and then we follow the pairs of particles. There will be one pair which has some exponential divergence, another pair which has another exponential divergence because this gamma exponent is going to fluctuate, another pair which has, again, another exponential divergence, and therefore what we expect that until that, and then when they reach the dissipative scale, they start to have the usual Richardson diffusion, and then when they reach the integral scale, they start to have the usual normal diffusion. What the problem is that if you now measure at fixed time, so you measure the Richardson diffusion in the usual way, what you expect to see is something like that. That there will be a very long time interval where you will have a mixture between different, if you average over all particles in your flow, you will have a mixture between different regimes. There will be some pair of particles which are still diffusive, another pair of particles which is inertial, and again here two pairs of particles which are inertial, and so on and so forth. So in order to really see the Richardson diffusion, you have to wait a very long time, and you have to be sure that all your pair of particles are indeed feeling the inertial physics. On the other hand, if you invert the statistics, that is, if you look at the diffusion, but instead then at fixed time, at fixed distances, that is, you ask the following question: what's the characteristic time you need to see a distance between two particles grows from R to R plus delta R, and then from R plus delta R to R plus 2 delta R, then you have a very simple way to select always inertial range physics, because it's enough to take and to measure statistics only when R is larger than your dissipative catalyst. So in this way, by performing an exit time of your exit time experiment, you are able to, in a unique way, to select only natural range physics and do not have this mixture coming from the dissipative beats. So what you expect, just by dimensional argument, is that if at fixed time r squared goes like t over q, at fixed delta r, the exit time, the mean exit time, should go like delta r to t to over t, to third. And this is demonstration of how it works. Here we have a numerical measurement of the Lagrangian dispersion made on a synthetic turbulent field, which means a stochastic field which has all the correct statistical properties of your usual turbulent flow. And what you see is that if you measure the mean dispersion between particles as a function of time, well, if you really know that they must go like t over 3/2, then you may draw a straight line here, and maybe you find one decade where you really see the initial confusion. But anyhow, you have a very long interplay between the viscous part and the integral part, which mainly prevents you from having a very good measurement of the slope of the natural range. On the other hand, if you measure the exit time statistics, then you have over something like seven decades, the straight line. Sorry, why five? Five, not seven. Is over five decades? Okay, over five decades, the correct exponent, which is, here it's just the inverse of the straight line. It's two-thirds, yes. The straight line is two-thirds. Yes, it's synthetic. Yes, the exponent is two-thirds. Then people have played with putting multifractal field and looking at the possible intermittent corrections on this slope, and they found very very small intermittent corrections. There is a work on the Richardson law. Yes. There is aerophysics and also physics of fluids by Boffetta, Celani, Vulpiani, and collaborators. I was not involved. Yes. Why constant? Why you see it?
Well, I'm a little worried about the time. Basically, what you argued before is in a sense there's a virtual argument for each at a particle time.
Yeah.
I'm sure what that problem is to plot out to the two-thirds versus two.
No, but I mean, this is not, sorry, this is not t, this is delta t, of course. I mean, that's, okay. I suppose that's. From when you
it's always dangerous to look for power laws on large loss plots if there's an offset or a constant.
Yeah, I mean that's this is the point. I agree with you. You must.
You've seen the same thing on my earlier plot. For example, not use the large loss plot, but use the plot of R to the 2/3 versus 2.
Well, but anyhow, you're. I don't understand. I mean, anyhow, you're going to have. No, but it's not a problem of power or power here. I mean, that's. The problem. Sorry.
It's a problem of offset.
It's the problem of the offset. Yes, but I don't understand why the power should. Anyhow, if you measure a fixed time, you're going to have a superposition between exponential and power. No, both. You see? So I mean, you must. Before really see the scaling, you have to be sure that all particles are in the natural range, and you can't be sure of that.
But both of them being a problem.
Okay, so right, let me jump to the Eulerian part of the talk. And I will be very phenomenological, and just to give you some idea of what one can expect from the exit time statistics. And well, we know that a very good way to reproduce the experimental result that you have in your anomalous exponent of velocity such a function is to suppose that the velocities are a power law behavior in as a function of the time increments with some exponent h which fluctuates along your time series. And this usual multifractal description, which has some some roots in the Navier-Stokes equations, because Navier-Stokes is invariant by this rescaling, and also recently, 1 year ago, 2 years ago, Ida and my collaborators proved that indeed you have to take into account of these possibilities of fluctuation of the H exponent if you want to have a meaningful closure of your Navier-Stokes equation. So I mean, I would say that the description is a little bit more than phenomenological at this point, because you have a connection with the Navier-Stokes equation, and you also know that if you want to close in some meaningful way the Navier-Stokes equation, you have to take into account of this scaling. So what you would say about, let us close our eyes, and if you want to have a guess on what is going to be the PDF or the exit time statistics, let us invert the selection. Let's say that the characteristic time you have to wait in order to see a fluctuation of the order delta V is going to be like delta V to 1 over H. And then, of course, you have also to invert, to do even an answer on what's the probability distribution function to have these kind of fluctuations. And again, you use the usual multifractal description, and you say, well, let's invert the multifractal probability distribution function. So the probability distribution function to have an exit time event of the order delta V 1 over H is going to be like delta V 3 minus P of H over H. At this point, you didn't really say anything because you don't know what the d of h is, and the point of interval was to try to calculate the d of h from Navier-Stokes equation. But anyhow, you are saying let me suppose that we know d of h because we see some experiments, I don't know, or Itamar give us the d of h curve, and then assuming this probability distribution function, I'm going to say something about the fluctuations of the exit time exponent, of course. And usually you perform the multifractal average. You say, well, if you want to measure the moment of order p of the exit time, you are just to integrate over all possible fluctuations, and you are going to have the usual expression. And if delta v is small enough, you have inertial range extended as you want, range of number as large as you want, you may perform a saddle point estimate of this guy. You are going to predict that the exit time statistics has a power law behavior in delta v with some exponent psi of p, which are just the saddle point estimate of this exponent here, just the minimum of possible h fluctuations of this curve. And just to
you know, I suppose, as long as you have
Exactly. This will be the point that, I mean, I mean, so far to move, exactly. And let me just compare with what you always have seen for the Dirac structure function, velocity, you study velocity difference at fixed delta t, then you perform exactly the same trick, and you have the usual scaling exponents, zeta p, with zeta p that is the minimum of a difference, I mean, the minimum of a function which depends on d of h, but which has, of course, a different functional dependency on d of h. Exactly. And so this is the point, somehow, because what it means, that now when you perform the saddle point, you discover the following fact, which is a trivial fact, if you want. That is, let me plot a possible D of H shape, I mean, a D of H shape which fits experiments, more or less. You expect that the maximum is going to be around one-third of the Kolmogorov exponent, because fluctuations are not very large from the Kolmogorov, in the exponents are not very large from the Kolmogorov prediction. And then what you discover is that the H exponent which realizes the saddle point for direct statistics for such a function is always on the left of this peak. So it's, the saddle point is always for such a function is always realized for typical fluctuations which are more singular than the Kolmogorov fluctuations, while the saddle point that realizes the saddle point for the inverse statistics, for exit time statistics, is always on the right on one-third. So again, we find again the previous statement that exit times are dominated by fluctuations which are more linear than the Kolmogorov typical fluctuation. So you see that in this sense, exit times probe a completely different physics of structural functions, because structural functions probe singularities which are more singular than Kolmogorov. Exit times probe singularities which are less singular. If you don't have a multifractal signal, but just a self-affine signal, then the DOH is just a support on one exponent, and the two statistics will be just one, trivially the inverse of the other. So, again, nothing of new. Now let's see what you see. Let's try to measure this exit time on experimental data. This is the first moment, the mean exit time as a function of delta V, measured on high Reynolds number data, that is Reynolds number, Reynolds lambda, something like 2000, from the wind panel of Yves Gagne in Grenoble. And what you see, these are, let me just look at the inset here. If you look at the direct statistics, the structural function, these are very good data. I mean, you can fit scaling exponents for the structural functions on something like two decades with an accuracy that is enough to really detect the intermediate correction. I mean, these are sigma 1 is the mean exit time, is the moment of order 1 of the exit time. Okay? While here S1 is the mean velocity fluctuation, it is the structural function of order 1. Modulus, of course. And you see that in the direct statistics, you have something like two decades of scaling, while if you look at the inverse statistics, you don't see any scaling at all. I mean, you have just, let me say, dimensionally speaking, you would expect something like the mean exit time goes like delta V to the cube in the inertial range, mean exit time goes like delta V, linear in delta V in the viscous range, just like obvious dimensional. And when you look at the exit time as a function of delta V, well, you see just a continuous bending, no power loss at all. If you are very optimistic, you say, well, asymptotically at very large delta V, you see something close to delta V cube. Asymptotically at very small delta V, you see something close to the viscous. To the viscous prediction. So the problem is why you don't see at all scaling loss in this, is there anything of a universal on
the same data, the wind tunnel data?
Same data, just one inverted with respect to the other one. One statistic inverted with respect to the other one. So fixed delta V instead of fixed delta T. Yeah. So the problem is why? Can we understand this behavior? And we think it's very simple to understand it, indeed. And there is some universal behind it. We think that we can understand it by invoking this intermediate dissipative range. What is the intermediate dissipative range? Well, it's now something like 10 years old proposal by Massimo Vergasolo and Miguel Frisch, and they say that if one wants to study what is going on between in the matching region between the viscous region and the inertial region, and if you believe in the multifactorial description, if you believe in the presence of anomalies, then you immediately discover that you are going to have a dissipative cutoff, which is a fluctuating quantity. Because if you have fluctuations which are of light, you're going to have some dissipative cutoff. If you have fluctuations which is less singular, you're going to have a different dissipative cutoff, and more singular, you're going to have a smaller dissipative cutoff. And so you're going to have, there will be a range of scales, which is called intermittent dissipative range, where some fluctuations are already in the viscous, some H exponents, so some fluctuations are already in the dissipative cutoff, while some other are still in the inertial, are already in the dissipative range, sorry, while some others are still in the inertial range. And so you're going to have an interplay here in all this in this range between dissipative and inertial physics. So how one can what does it mean? It means that if we go back to our D of H curve, it means the following: that when you perform the settle point estimate, you realize that as a function of delta V, when delta V becomes very small, there will be some fluctuations which are killed that you cannot anymore take into account here in this integral, because fluctuations with those H have already been killed by the viscous dissipation mechanism. So what you expect is that if you are looking at this guy, moment over the t of the x time, you would expect that there will be. You expect that there is. The h value which satisfies your saddle point for that particular moment, which is going to be somehow somewhere here, and then you see that for until delta v is larger, delta v is going to give you the minimum h exponent which is still alive at that scale. If delta v is enough large that the saddle point is still satisfied, you're going to have the usual saddle point estimate. But then if you still decrease delta v, at some point you will have that for that velocity fluctuations, the exponent which satisfies your saddle point is no more alive, has been killed by viscous dissipation, and so the saddle point is just realized by the extremum of the integral of the interval of h exponents which are still alive, and so you will have a saddle point which changes as a function of delta v, also for what concerns the exponent, the properties of the exponent. So what you predict simply. This is just a Fischberg-Gatow argument rephrased on the inverse for the inverse statistics. What's pretty simple is that you're going to have, in principle, you're going to have a saddle point which gives you an exponent that, if delta v is large enough, is a number which depends only on p. If delta v becomes smaller than some critical value, this is the value where the h star is no more alive, then the exponent is going to become a function of delta v. And so you don't have any more Pavlov behavior, but you're going to have a pseudo-algebraic law because you're in this point you have also dependent on delta v. But what's the point? The point is that now you realize here is just the same written. So you predict for the moment of the exit time that if delta v is large enough, there will be a velocity dissipative cutoff for each p, that if delta v is large enough, you have the usual natural range behavior. If delta v is smaller than this velocity cutoff, you have the intermediate dissipative range. And then what you realize is that because the h exponent, which gives you the saddle point estimate, is always on the right hand side of the peak, the velocity cutoff where you start to see the intermediate dissipative range is always larger than the typical velocity Kolmogorov fluctuation. What it means is that the IDR, the intermediate dissipative range, for the inverse statistics, appears for velocity fluctuations which are larger than the Kolmogorov fluctuation. So completely penetrate in the inertial range, in what you would have called inertial range. So in this way, you understand first why the IDR was never detected in direct structural function, because IDR indirect structure function happens at scales which are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale, and it's very difficult to detect numerically or experimentally effects which are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale. And now we argue, you understand why in the inverse statistics you don't see any power law, because the continuous bending is just an effect given by the IDR. Then you can quantify this, because there is a universal prediction that you can extract from the IDR. The universal prediction is the following. Well, you say that, you see, you have these two behavior, well inside the inertial range, and, when you have a Pavlov behavior and a pseudo-algebraic law, and you realize that there is a rescaling procedure, because you realize that you can write, if you study the log of the inverse structural functions divided by viscosity versus the log of the velocity fluctuations divided by viscosity, you realize the previous two expressions are independent of the viscosity. So become the IDR become these two expressions, which in principle are dependent on the viscosity because we have this exponent here, becomes independent of the viscosity. So you have a precise prediction that tells you plot things in this way, and you should see a universal function of the function of theta, both in the natural range and both in the IDR, independent on the Reynolds number, if your effect is given by the IDR. Now let us see what we found. So what we did.
So you're saying you find the variable starting to plot the function
Exactly. I mean, you know that the natural range is a stupid function, then it's going to bend, but it's independent of Reynolds number.
But it's a function of the single variable, which is then independent of Reynolds number.
Exactly. This is what the idea formalism tells you. So what we did is the following. First, we took... In convection? I don't know. You?
Ah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. When? Do you remember? Okay.
You don't mean just by multiplying the exponent of the decay?
No. It's some kind of double logarithmic.
Yeah, log log. So there is a state species of.
Okay, so let me show what how we tested this possible universal rescaling shape. What we did first, we took again this surrogate of a velocity field. This is a stochastic field which has the multi-affine properties, meaning the anomalous. This figure is synthetic. Synthetic but multifractal. And when we could switch on and off the viscosity, because you can smooth the signal as you want. And what we... Sorry? NS is non-smoothed. Not smoothed. Not Navier-Stokes. Then you're going to have the Navier-Stokes. Next plot, but also the experimental data.
NS prime.
NS prime. No, maybe experiment or something. So no, NS is for not smoothed. So in this, we had this synthetic signal, we could measure the exit time statistics. And if you do not put any viscosity at all, you find a very good power law behavior. That's what you expected from the previous formalism. And then you start to switch on viscosity to decrease Reynolds number, and you start to see this tendency toward a continuous bending from a viscous behavior to an inertial energy behavior. So this is a way to have, say, a synthetic experiment where you can change Reynolds number at your wish. Then what we did, so we have these, let's say, three different Reynolds number experiments. This is infinite Reynolds number. Three different Reynolds number set of data. And we had the previous experimental data. And we tried to perform these rescaling procedures. And this is what it turns out. Here there are the three numerical experiments plus the true experimental data, and rescaled according to the IDR rescaling procedure, and you find a quite good collapse of all your data. How much this is good, you can decide. It's very difficult. I mean, either is correct. When you plot log-log, it's very difficult to say how nice is the rescaling, but I mean, at least this proved that it's not in contradiction, let me say.
Including the
experiment. The nice feature is that including the experiment, you find that a quite good rescaling. Yeah, this is what we understand at the observation of the intermediate interpretation range exists.
Or this is one interpretation.
It's one interpretation, exactly. The non-smooth data you can't indeed perform the scaling for non-smooth because you have to divide it by the viscosity in the scaling procedure. No? That you remember. The scaling function was something like that. You have to plot such a function. So the non it sends everything to infinite. Yes. It sends everything to infinite. You're right. So, I lost. Okay, let me conclude this part very briefly, with an observation that you may deny. Because quite often you read statements that tell you ESS is incompatible with IDR. And indeed, these are correct, in the sense that if you have IDR, you cannot have ESS on the same range of scales, because IDR tells you that the viscous cutoff change. ESS is kind of similarity. This is this way, this trick to plot data that has to extract And you extract the scaling exponent and relative scaling exponent and absolute scaling exponent. And it is, sorry? And indeed, the two effects are incompatible in the sense that they cannot happen in the same range of scales. But what happens in the direct structure function is that, for the usual structure function, is that IDL is an effect which shows up at scales which are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale. ESS is an effect which shows up at scales which are larger than the Kolmogorov scale. And so the two are perfectly compatible. On the other hand, in the inverse statistics, in the inverse statistics, we know that IDL shows up at scales which are larger than the Kolmogorov scale, and then you should deduce that ESS is not there, cannot be there. And indeed, if you try to plot in the ESS way inverse such a function, you do not see any improvement in the scaling. In the scaling. It's just a simple remark. Jensen did this in the shell model. In the shell model. Yeah, but there, in his case, I mean, I do not like that much his way to study inverse statistics in the shell model, because he has to reconstruct from the shell model, which is a dynamics in the Fourier space, he has to reconstruct a dynamics in the real space. And it is very tricky, very, very tricky. So one can argue that if the two measurements are really equivalent or not. You can anyhow formally kill me. And well, they can fall asleep a bit. So in the last 10 minutes, I would like very briefly show you how one can access, compute. These are somehow different arguments, but at the very end I will be back to turbulent signal, so there is some connection. How one can compute epsilon entropies by using active signs. And our statement is that indeed the optimal way to measure epsilon entropy is by using active time statistics. And the argument goes as follows. Let me just write very briefly, it would work very familiar by itself, what the epsilon entropy is. What we want to have is a way to quantify the degree of complexity of your trajectory, given any dynamical system. You want a way to quantify the degree of complexity of your trajectory within some precision, let's say epsilon precision. What it means, you take the phase space, you perform a coarse graining on your phase space with cells which have a diameter of the epsilon, then you look at the trajectory on a discretized time series, and from the discretized trajectory in a discretized space, you extract a symbolic dynamic. If the trajectory is, what it means is that if you have an infinitely long trajectory, you're going to have an infinitely long sequence of symbols, and the symbols are just the labels of the cells that have been visited by the trajectory. So now you have an infinite sequence of symbols, and you want to characterize the complexity of this sequence, and the only mathematical correct way to do it is using the Shannon entropy and entropy concept. What you do, you have these infinite sequences of symbols, so first you calculate block entropies, which are the entropies measured on words or sequences with n symbols. And you perform the usual, you estimate the probability by the frequency of these words, and then you sum over all possible words of a given length, and you have an entropy. Then you define a difference between entropies calculated on words with n plus 1 symbols minus entropy calculated on words with n symbols. You normalize by tau, because you want something which is independent on tau, for tau small enough. And then you send n to infinity. You send n to infinity because you want somehow something that, from a dynamical point of view, is invariant, is independent on the trajectory you are picking. And this defines you what is called an epsilon tau entropy. And from the epsilon tau entropy, you define the Kolmogorov Sinai entropy. And the Kolmogorov Sinai entropy is just the limit of the epsilon tau entropy when tau goes to 0 and epsilon goes to 0. This is the limit of your entropy when the partitions become more and more refined. The Kolmogorov Sinai entropy is a basic tool in dynamical system theory, because you can prove that for chaotic system the Kolmogorov Sinai entropy is strictly larger than 0. Then you can prove that for predictable system the model of finite entropy is exactly equal to zero mean for periodic or quasi periodic system. And maybe you're right. Maybe you're right, of course. You're right, sorry. First of all, you have to perform the unit tau. So something which is independent of tau, the external entropy, And then for stochastic system, you can prove that the Komorowski entropy is strictly infinite. Okay, so what? The argument now is that, the observation now is that, indeed you are almost, for all realistic applications, you are almost never interested in Komorowski entropy, because either you have a stochastic system, so it is infinite, and so you want just to control how the epsilon entropy diverges when you send epsilon to zero, or even if you have a chaotic, purely chaotic deterministic system, even if the Komorowskian entropy is finite, is so large that you cannot compute unless the system is so low dimensional that it's almost uninteresting. So most of the time what you really want to know, if you want to characterize the real complexity of your transaction, is what happens to the epsilon entropy at changing epsilon. So you want to characterize the real complexity of your trajectory depending on the resolution you're looking at your system. So the now the statement is that exit times are the optimal way to calculate the epsilon entropy. And especially when you have intermittent situations, you have some correlation in your system. The reason is the following. Let us look at two possible different ways to code one trajectory. Let us look at a possible way to extract a symbolic dynamics from a trajectory. Let me suppose I have a one-dimensional phase space, irregular time. So I perform a partition of my phase space, cell number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then the usual way to extract a symbolic dynamics is to say, well, at time 1 I was in cell number 1, so I put 1. At time 2, 3, 4 I was in cell number 2, so I put 2. And then you see, when you have a strong correlation, so strong laminar situation where the signal does not change at all, you are, if you code the dynamics in the usual way, you are forced to waste a lot of coding, because for a very long time you look at the system and you discover that it is always in the same cell. And so you have to put a lot of three, then eventually you exit and you have a non-trivial effect. But if you want to characterize the degree of this trajectory on a coarse grain over the epsilon, of course what is happening here inside you do not care at all. So on the other hand, if you code the dynamics by the exit time, of course this effect is no more there, because when you have a rough behavior, coding by the exit time or in the usual way is almost the same. But when you have a strong laminar phase, here you have just to code according to the exit time statistics, you have just to store one number, the value of the exit time, and possible one symbol that is plus or minus, because you also want to control if you're exiting from above or from below. And what is interesting is that, of course, the two way of coding are in a one-to-one correspondence. That is, you can, given this, I can extract these sequences. Given this sequence, I can extract the exit time sequence. This is the crucial observation, because it tells you that because the two codings are in a one-to-one correspondence, then the total entropy must be the same, because the information is the same. In the two coded sequences, the information is the same. But the total entropy of the usual way of coding is just the total time, capital time, times the external entropy of the unit time. The total entropy of the exit time coding is just the number of exits times the entropy per exit. And so you discover that the epsilon entropy per unit of time is just the epsilon entropy per exit divided the mean exit time, because capital time divided m, m is the total number of exits, capital time divided m is just the mean exit time. And what is nice is that you can prove that the leading behavior as a function of epsilon of this size is given by the exit time. This gives you at maximum a logarithmic correction. So if you want to understand what is going on the epsilon entropy as a function of epsilon, it's enough to control the mean exit time. You can write upper and lower bound of this numerator, which are logarithmic. And so what you prove, what it tells you is that, and now you see that you are in business, because What is very difficult to measure is the entropy. Well, the mean excitation is a trivial measurement. And so if you want to measure the epsilon entropy unit time, it's enough to measure the mean exit time if you code the sequences by the exit time.
On the left-hand
side, exactly. I can bound the numerator. There is upper and lower bound on the numerator, you can prove it. This is the entropy of the sequence of exit time symbols. And it's just this goes like maximum like logarithmic of x. I mean, you can perform the worst upper bound just logarithm of epsilon times the number of symbols that you have used. So it's supposed to be at worst logarithmic. And this, I mean, of course, if your epsilon entropy is logarithmic, you are in trouble anyway. But if your epsilon entropy has a power law behavior, then the power law behavior is picked by the mean exit time. So now this is true. We didn't find this in the literature. There is a very short remark. There is a very short remark on Gaspar Wang of Physics paper.
Well, no.
Sorry, what's the?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you I mean, what we were able to find was only a very short remark by Gaspar and Wang in the physics paper on maximum power entropy, where they say at some point they maybe want to use extra time to calculate the entropy, but they do not show any example. Well, it would be interesting. So now, let me conclude. One can apply all these concepts to turbulence. Well, for example, one can now, let me suppose I have a one-dimensional turbulent signal, I can measure the epsilon entropy of the turbulent signal. Now, epsilon is delta V, of course. I mean, this is your coarse grain in your phase space. And what you see is that the delta V entropy, let me call it in this way, of the turbulent signal is going to be proportional to the inverse of the exit time. The inverse of the exit time, there is a subtle point that, I mean, I don't want to go into maybe too long. But I mean, the inverse of the exit time, if you now use the multifractal description, is going to give you the prediction that must scale as a function of delta V like psi to minus 1. And what is nice is that psi minus 1 is equal to 3. Psi of order minus 1. Psi was the exponent of the multifactorial average of exercise. And yeah, exactly. And what is nice is that psi of minus 1 is always equal to 3 independently on the D of H spectrum. This is the equivalent of the four-fifth law for the entropy measurement. That if you impose theta is equal to 1, then psi minus 1 is equal to 3. Somehow it tells us that intermittency does not change the content of the information that you have in your signal.
Which is you distribute the space.
Exactly. I mean, to us it was not straightforward. Yes, exactly. Well, so now I conclude, I would say, yeah. Let me conclude. So English statistics. Well, gives independent tests in terms of the usual direct essential functions, as we saw, because they weight the right-hand side of the D of H curve, are good for minimizing strong dissipation effects in the Lagrangian measurement. The statistics is able to highlight the dissipative physics in the linear measurement, are connected with entropic content, and some proposals for the future, just to say two things. One possibility would be to use to look at the same observable in the 2D. You have already solved it?
Yeah.
Because
I know how to solve it.
Okay. Okay, so no new features.
You can check my physics.
Okay.
Okay.
It happens? For this? Yeah. And then a second possibility, just to write down something, is that exit times measures the laminar turbulent fluctuations. So laminar turbulent fluctuations, if you believe to phenomenology, should be somehow connected, should be somehow important to passive scalar fluctuations, because passive scalar, if you write down the usual Obuchov coefficient prediction, should be proportional to the to a negative power of the energy dissipation. Suppose when you are linear, you have strong passive, as you know it, because it produces the shot. Exactly. And so you imagine that somehow there may be some nice cross correlation between exit time moment and passive scalar fluctuations that maybe can be measured and can give us some insight on the passive. Okay. So that's all. Okay. Yeah.
Look, I wanted to ask you what would the implication be in two dimensions, where the entropy cascade wave range is characterized by an exponent of 2, yeah, and the dissipated range is characterized by the exponent is also 2.
And
then would you see any crossover?
Well, the point is that I was discussing with Grisha. It is in the 2D, what you know about the DOH curve is that here you have H equal 1, let's say that the flow is laminar. You don't have anything on the left of H equal 1. You can't have fluctuations which are exactly. Then what you may argue is that maybe you have something which is more smooth than a differentiable field, and the exit time is going to measure that one. And for those fluctuations, you are going to have this idea again that goes in your inertial range, two-dimensional inertial range regime, because those fluctuations are going to happen at scales which are larger in dissipative scale, also in your 2D cascade regime. Then, if this curve exists or not,
in the cascade, the difference between this curve and the inertial is that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in the direct structure function you don't have the room.
So you won't see anything on that path.
Unless you don't see logarithm, you can see logarithm.
Divide by R, and then plot versus logarithm, which is straight line.